Just another wine podcast.
Just another wine podcast. What a beautiful name for a wine podcast. So, you're here with me, Jamie Good.
And Emily Harmon.
And Doug Rigg.
And today, we're going to be talking about Your faults, my flaws.
And stop laughing at me. It's just something, an inspiration I had.
This is Doug's title, but it's a topic that I really love. And the briefing he gave us, is there a clear line in the sand between faults or flaws, or is it blurred by personal taste? Should we examine flavour as something apart from the wine being the aggregate of chemical and microbiological transformation? That's a beautiful way of putting it. You've got a way with words. What did you study at university?
words.
English words? Yes.
That's what Hamlet said. When Polonius asked him what he's studying, he said words. I like language, yes. I also love discussing faults and flaws because I've lived in a binary world in wine, I guess we all have, in which if it's not perfect, it's faulty. There's no other way of looking at it. And I'm a relative kind of guy. I believe in Einstein. I believe in relativity. I believe that that a lot of what we interpret are according to our palate, that certain faults could well be flaws. And think about it. Like, are human beings perfect? You know, are we symmetrical? No, we're flawed. And actually, our flaws are what make us beautiful. And I would submit, here's my proposition for the day, and you can argue with it, and we'll argue around it, is that flaws truly are what make wine unique and beautiful. And if every wine was robotically faultless, then it would be splendidly null, imperfectly perfect. There you are, some more words.
It's difficult to follow up after that.
I just quoted Tennyson. Misquoted Tennyson.
I know, I'm just
end of episode.
This is a good starting point. Emily, how do you feel about the issue of wine faults? You've been a sommelier, so this is the thing that I think is very interesting, is that can you think of any other product where when presenting it to the customer, you give them a little bit to see if there's a problem? Like when you bring your food to the table, you don't bring them a little... cut a little bit of the steak off and just taste the steak. Is the steak okay?
I know, it's very interesting. And it's funny because if you think about cheese, for example, and all of the vast range of flavours and aromas that actually, if you isolate them on their own, they're quite challenging in cheese, but they're very widely accepted, but not in wine. So, I think definitely agreeing with Doug on the binary world. And I think, again, it's a little bit similar to what we discussed in the first episode of sort of the strong views on natural wine. And there is this huge space between each of those polars, maybe not with everything, but then there's a lot of factors. I mean, you've written the book on this, right? So I'm treading a bit carefully with what I'm saying. We have this huge space of certain flaws that I think can add, like volatile acidity, can add complexity. You know, when you look at other industries like floristry, for example, putting jasmine into a bunch of flowers, which is very high on the chemical note indole, I think we've talked about this before, can help lift other floral tones in the bouquet. And it can be a benefit to the bouquet of flowers to add more complexity and add more aroma. And I see that in wine. I find that very intriguing. And I think a little bit of my experience of wine, or let's say my window of tolerance for flaws and faults, right? Because I think we all have a different window of tolerance for these things. We also have different sensitivities and perception, and some of us don't have any perception with it, right? But for me, I think of it a little bit like that of meeting a person. I like the things that are imperfect. I like a lack of symmetry on a face. I'm very intrigued by something that's very specific and unique to that individual. And I find it very, very fascinating to sort of dig away. But again, it's like too much of something is too much, right? So it's like finding that spot of intrigue and interest, without it being overwhelming. But that applies on the flip side of something being very sterile and industrial for me too, where it's lacking soul. I'm often shown wines at the moment in the Netherlands, the UK, Austria and Germany for different consultancy projects. And I'm often put lots of different wines in front of me. And then you have these wines that are just like perfectly made. You know, you're like, yes, this does taste like Nerello Mascalese from Etna. And yeah, I can kind of tell this is from volcanic soil and it's textbook and everything else. But do I want to drink another glass? Am I going to remember that? Does it stay with me? What's the resonance of that wine? And I feel that sometimes a wine with flaws or faults, it can have more of this resonant character that really stays with me that I find intriguing. Of course, I'm not talking about cork taint when I'm talking about this because the threshold for that is very low for me. Mousiness is the other one. But, you know, Brettanomyces, VA, these are all things that actually I can find can add an intriguing note that I really appreciate. That's my 2 cents.
Jamie, we've discussed, Brett, because I think there was a period of time when a lot of wine writers particularly objected to Brettanomyces in wines. And weirdly, I've always found that in some wines, it's like a seasoning. It enhances certain flavours, like sort of umami or gaminess or sort of a bacony thing, which I actually really like in certain wines. For example, Merlot. I really like it because it gives almost like a Rhone character. I quite like it in other grape varieties, Grenache, but I don't like it in Pinot Noir because I think there's a delicate grape which is very much about translating terroir and has a sort of primary character. And I just think that Brett would perhaps spoil that character. What do you think, James?
I think I agree with you in that sense. I think that I remember my first encounter when I first got into wine, I was drinking wine without really understanding what I was drinking, but I had very strong ideas about what I liked and didn't like. I remember somebody brought round I read about Domaine Richaume from the Provence, and I got hold of a bottle and I drank it, and it was like what I recognise now as Brettanomyces was very strong and savoury. And then a friend, Nigel, came to dinner and he brought a bottle of Crozes Hermitage, and it was like the same gamey sort of animally, you know, horsey sort of character. And as a novice wine drinker, I didn't like that at all. So it's a firm no from me. And then I began to learn about what these different faults were. And it's like sometimes when you learn to recognise a fault compound, then whenever you spot it, the first thing you do is reject the wine because you've spotted the fault compound without asking, well, how does it work in that context? Now, if I was a winemaker, I'd do everything I could to avoid Brettanomyces, you know, because I think it can be a dominant feature. It's very hard to control. Something that can blur the boundaries of terroir. You can have a Bretty wine that tastes like many other Bretty wines. But at the same time, some people make wines. You can recognise, if you look carefully, the flavours, compounds that come from Brettanomyces, but they work really well. And I remember somebody doing an analysis when I was first getting into wine on the bulletin boards of some famous vintages of Bocastel. And they looked at 4-EP, which is 4-ethyl phenol, which is a compound that's only produced by Brettanomyces in wine. And they were off the charts, these levels.
Yeah.
Yet these were wines, I think it was in 1990 or something, that these are wines that were highly sought after by collectors. And then Sam Harrop, his MW dissertation, looked at Syrah and Brettanomyces. And we did a tasting where we were tasting all these famous Syrah wines blind. And we had to say whether we thought they were Bretty or not. And then he went and did an analysis of all those wines for 4-EP to see whether they were Bretty or not. And some very famous names had above threshold levels of 4-EP. And so I think that sometimes Brettanomyces can be interesting. It's something I wouldn't want if I was making wine, but sometimes it can be a complexing fact. But it seems to manifest itself differently in different wines as well. So sometimes I'll be drinking a wine and enjoying it, and someone will say, oh, it's a bit Bretty. I say, oh, maybe it is. Oh, okay. So this is one of the examples of faults.
Don't you think VA can be like that too sometimes?
VA totally can. I'm not quite sensitive to VA in the sense that I spot it and I go, oof, VA. But then I think, oh, wait a minute, yeah, I recognise the VA. Does it mean I have to reject the wine, or can I try and appreciate this wine?
Yeah.
But again,
with the characters it's
got. Don't some producers want to work with VA? Because if you're in a hot climate, there's sort of like almost vinegary. Am I going to say the word right? But is it? There's an element which gives a balsamic note to the wine, yeah. which offsets the sort of maybe the slightly baked fruit character.
Yes.
It gives it some definition.
It's interesting. No, it gives a sweet... VA gives a sweet acidity as well. There's a sweetness it brings. So a little bit of VA, maybe to the point where it's below the recognition threshold, will actually help the wine to be more interesting. And then I remember a seminar at one of your real wine fairs by some dude from
Chad
Oregon.
Stock, who is three deliberately bretty wines.
Wasn't it like, I like a bit of VA? The name of the wine or something like that?
It's like what it is, it's that he's saying that VA presents differently. So if you've just got the acetic acid element, that can be really quite nice. But if you've got ethyl acetate, which is other comes along with the then ethyl acetate can be quite unpleasant.
Mm.
So it's like, that's, I think that was his point, that there's different sorts of VA. There's a very nuanced look at the issue of VA, but super interesting.
He also did the same with Brett, actually. Yeah. And he played with Brett, Vineyard Brett, which, for example, we work with a producer, and one vineyard always presents bretty wines, but the other ones don't. And I think one of the, perhaps the misnomers or the misunderstandings is people say it's bad hygiene in the winery, but there can be extraneous factors that give you the terroir of Brett or Breton, you know. But as a flavouring agent, I mean, after all, Brett is used in beers. We have Brett beers, don't we?
Yeah. And we like it in Belgian.
Yeah, we like it in Belgian beers. And as Emily said earlier, like, we don't mind cheese running across the table with alacrity. So, you know, we like a bit of wild sometimes. And actually, if it pushes the envelope in wine, it can be really exciting. You wouldn't necessarily want to drink these wines all the time. But I think in terms of expanding your flavour vocabulary, it's really intriguing. And also to understand why it happens, when it happens, and whether it adds a little accent to the wine that it might be missing.
Now we're running into this concept of wabi-sabi, the Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, the idea that small flaws can bring up beauty in very interesting ways. And I think one of these ideas would be, for instance, if you're in an old country house, you know, you're in the hallway.
The imperfect beams running along the ceiling.
No, you hear the ticking of the grandfather clock or the grandmother clock. I don't know if
there's... In the silence, yes.
So that ticking, so that imperfection, something breaking the silence, makes you realise it's silent. A lot of the drip, you're a pool of water, you hear a drip. Pop. Pop. It's very little noise that's an imperfection, it's a flaw. It's breaking the silence, but it helps you to understand the silence. And I think with wine, I think about that sometimes. I think that a totally clean, pure, fruity wine, it's like, what's the point? We need something else there. You need it's like when I was, again, when I was, I remember going to this shop in Wallington, I just started getting interested in wine, and I was going there, and there was it was called the Wine House, and I'd go in and say to the owners, Morvin and Sue, I'd say, this is what I found about the last wine. This is what I really would like to find in this wine. What about this wine? And sometimes I went to try a famous wine. They go, oh, no, you're not ready for that. Don't go for that yet. Try this. And then one day I went in. I just had this Mount Barker 1985 Forest Hill Shiraz. And the thing I loved about it was so smooth and sweet. The tannins are so... And I went, I want something smooth, no tannin. A red wine, smooth, no tannin. Really fruity. And the proprietor, Sue, she said, are you sure you wouldn't rather just have some fruit juice? And it's like, the idea being that what I was looking for is like I was avoiding things that maybe were a little challenging, like tannin. Mm. As I just wanted the joy of the pleasure of the sweet fruit. But without the other things in the wine, the sweet fruit is meaningless. The sweet fruit on its own is fruity, and that's like delicious. But it's like having baby bell cheese. What's the point? You know, if you want cheese, you want the flavours, different flavours, sometimes challenging flavours. And you need those that mix of the joyful and immediately gratifying with things that are maybe a little bit more elusive and difficult to
understand. Isn't like this like the palate of babies? Like, we, you know, babies like sweet things and round things and soft things and fruity things and sugary things.
But they also like
overcooked.
No, I think it's more about actually how the flavour receptors are developed, because a young child doesn't, I think, the bitterness is like one of the first things that they can taste. So that's why there's this curiosity towards lemon. So it's something about how the taste buds and everything develop, which is why they don't have the same like reaction to lemon that
maybe
we
it's
have,
machine
for
learning as well. It's the idea is they're trying to put as many data points together about what the world out there is like, to understand the world outside in terms of objects. And I think this is to do with smell. It's very much like that. We can go into a crowded marketplace and recognize the smell of pizza over there and coffee over here. Even though all these molecules are flying around in the air, we've learned to recognize that when these molecules co-occur together, you know, with a certain latitude, because there's lots of different smells of coffee, we recognize it as coffee, as an object, as a smell object in that sense. And we'll recognize pizza or recognize someone, you know, with beef on the grill or something. You can smell that. And it's like they can be very many different variations around that theme, but we categorize them as this particular theme. Mm. And I think that's really interesting. So maybe what you're doing with flavor is you're learning to recognize things in terms of objects of flavor. So we're always on the lookout to see new flavor combinations go together. But when we get something that's a little disjointed, that causes us to, the error signal comes up. We say, what's that? And that's where I think it's with this sense of flaws. You know, some people are willing to go into a slightly difficult place, an unusual place, and have new experiences. Other people, I think, want to stay in a comfortable place that they've learned to recognise this as wine.
Well, don't orange wines come into this? Because I think when orange wines appeared, you know, more than just one isolated example, people looked at the colour, said, that's wrong. It's not a white wine. You know, what's wrong with it? Is it oxidised? That was the first instinct, because they'd not seen a colour. They had not had no reference point to that colour. So automatically suspicious, they tried the wine. Where's the acidity? It's the bitterness. Bitterness is not something you necessarily associate with white wines. Whatever white wines you like, you're looking for acidity by definition. So already your taste buds are discombobulated. You think it's faulty because you don't recognize it. Now I think people are much more experienced. They've tried a wider range of wines. They would say, well, it's in that category, even though I may not like it. I recognize it. It has a place on a list. So much so that orange wines now demand their own section on a list. Mm. But before then, you know, like I think when we opened Terroir, someone ordered orange wine. Oh no, they didn't know they were ordering orange wine. They thought they were ordering a white Malvasia from La Stoppa. Bottle came, was decanted into a carafe, came to the table, and there was this almost frisson of shock. Like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, because the Stoppa white wines, that's pretty extreme as well. They're often quite bretty as well. There's a white wine with Brettanomyces.
And quite a bit of VA as well.
It's not a beginner's wine, is it?
And in a decanter.
No, I don't think it's a beginner's
wine. And in a decanter and served at room temperature. It was like
that's terrifying.
All your favourite whammies at once. Anyway, this person looked at it and sort of pointed. And then said, that's not what I ordered. I ordered a white wine. And there was a customer sitting at the next table, turned around and said, that is what is known as an orange wine. It is achieved by skin contact with the must. And I was thinking, like, the customer's doing my job for me, you know. And the guy accepted it and drank it. And I thought, this is a miracle that people are open-minded. We should perhaps give people credit for being open-minded. But I think once you have explained to you what's going on, cognitively, you come to terms with it. Or you may not like it, but you come to terms with the idea that the wine is meant to be like that. And therefore, the associated taste that you get, and as a sommelier, I always tell people, gave them an indication of what it would taste like. I said, look, you taste it, this is sort of the thing you'll be tasting, this is why you're tasting it, but if you don't like it, you don't have to drink it, it's not a contract. And people, as I say, became much more accepting of the wine because they felt confidence that it was meant to be the way it was meant to be. And I think with faults and flaws, to try to bring it back to the subject, I think this is the same thing. It's like if you point out something as a flaw, as a natural flaw, is a result of not filtering or skin contact or whatever, and then that flaws are this aesthetic element that Jamie was talking about, the wabi-sabi element, they have a kind of beauty in themselves. People will probably more likely to accept that. If they think it's a fault, then they begin to worry about it, and then it becomes amplified. And if the only fault they know is cork taint, even if it's an oxidized wine or a mousy wine, they'll say it's corked because they clutch on to the fort as a security blanket. And I think what we're going to discuss is, are there some forts which are absolute, others which are semi-absolute, but more of a matter of taste, and ones which are actually not forts at all, but something that enhances the wine or has the capacity to enhance the wine?
I think reduction is interesting. So when we're talking about reduction, we're talking about the presence of volatile sulfur compounds in wine. So obviously, if you smell hydrogen sulfide, which is the eggy, drainy sort of smell, that's a fault. I don't think anyone can like that. It's what stink bombs, you know, are made of, hydrogen sulfide. But when it's more complex, sulfides or thiols, or, you know, the classic example being that matchstick struck flint character often found in white wines, I think that can be a very positive thing. It's like a seasoning, I guess you'd say. So a little bit in the right context can be really good. But if it becomes an artifact, then it's exaggerated. It's like oak. I know a winemaker who says that if you can spot oak in a wine, it's a fault.
Mm.
That's an opinion, you know. So, and I think there's some support for that opinion, and that you don't want to be tasting oak.
No.
A French forest in a bottle of wine. But oak can have an enhancing effect when it's at the right sort of level. I think the one thing that we would say is always a fault is cork taint. If you can perceive it in the wine, you can't drink that wine and enjoy it. You'd have to be very desperate for the alcohol hit to be able to drink a corky wine. But reduction, I think, is very interesting, because reduction is one of those ones where I think it can be very complexing in the right
But context. It can bind to the wine as well.
But that's when it becomes a fault, right?
Like, yes.
When it's not going away.
So reduction, if it can dissipate, if you can leave it, I don't know, to carafe it or do something and remove that reduction, I think it and the wine comes out, that's fine. There are reductive elements. We use the word reductive as a wine description of something which focuses like a sense of minerality, for example, in certain wines, and it still has that matchstick element to it, but it's not a sort of burning element. But I want to come into my pet subject, sulfur. I was born in a puff of sulfur, obviously. I find when I...
That should be a T-shirt.
yes. No, I'm like, I know people wear T-shirts who say, I am a Brett Nazi. So I can say I'm a sulfur Nazi.
Sulfites, if you could detect the sulfites, you don't like it.
If they burn the wine. And
I can't remember the last wine I had where I said, oh, I'm tasting sulfites.
I can. And
so this is an interesting discussion about perception and whether you find something more if you're looking for it. And also maybe I'm just not used to looking for it.
I mean, I think before you explain, because it could be interesting to get your perspective on this in your explanation, because as somebody who sells a lot of low sulfur and sometimes no sulfur wines to restaurants in Germany, there's a couple of customers sometimes that assume the wines have higher sulfites, where they say, oh, we thought the wines were low sulfites, right? But everybody who we work with would be like half of what would even be considered possible a natural wine fair. So like added maximum 30, max, right? So then by the time it's been a bottle and it's already on market, that's already gone down, right? But to get that feedback, I sometimes don't know how to navigate those conversations, because it's a little bit tricky of like,
if
you don't want to make somebody...
free sulfur dioxide is 30 parts. People can't spot that.
But it's
so they're not spotting the sulfites.
That's what I mean. So this is where I think there's a lot of ideas that certain people have around how to identify sulfites in wine. So I think it could actually be really interesting to hear about, for you, when you're like, hey, this is sulfites, what is that like? Because I think there's a lot of miseducation around the sulfur topic, and there's a lot of numbers people grasp onto. And I don't know if it's much of an interesting topic as people make it out to be. That's my perspective, but I'd like to know your thoughts.
Okay, well, I approach from various angles. Firstly, on the science side, I'm not terribly sure I am confident about lab analysis, because you see a lab analysis which is incredibly high amount of total sulfites, like 120 or 130, and it doesn't taste like it, or a slightly surprisingly low and it tastes like it's like quite sulfury. I think in terms of a sensation, and this is why I I don't equate it with a fault as such. It's just bad winemaking, which you may say is faulty or not faulty. But I find it's as a safety net. It's like too high up. It's so when I taste a wine, I'm looking for energy. I'm looking for movement. I'm looking for fluidity, and I find that sulfur blocks a wine really early on in the palate. So it's like it only gets across a part of my tongue before I get this burning sensation. This burning sensation burns the fruit, stops the acidity, the fluidity, the mouth-watering element of the wine. And to be absolutely honest, I cannot drink a second glass of it. I couldn't even drink the first glass of it. And I find that it's spoiling the wine because it's not necessary. It should not be necessary to put sulfites in at that level where they're still detectable. If you put sulfites in wine and they're there, they're bound to the wine somehow, and they're fine, and they focus the wine in a particular way, and they protect the wine because they were necessary to protect the wine, I don't have a problem with that. What I find is that people use it like seasoning, like salt, without tasting whether or not the wine needs it. And as a result of conventional winemaking, perhaps using yeast, perhaps using other additives, perhaps filtering, you destroy anything that is personal and individual and singular about the wine. And therefore, I think that sulfur is in itself not it's a natural compound. It's an antiseptic. It can be used and is even used in natural winemaking judiciously. It's just overused and abused in so many cases to such an extent. There is a point that I personally think it's faulty. And on the very few times I've been invited on into wine competitions, and people are saying, well, that's bretty, we knock it out, we give it like a nothing. And I say, well, fair enough, but I can't drink this wine. If I can't drink it, I can't recommend it. So it's a fault as far as I'm concerned.
What about for under-sulfured wines? Because sometimes there are wines, the mousy wines, right? Like where sometimes it would be quite nice if maybe...
Now, I think mousiness is a really interesting topic. But I think I'm going to intervene here
with the wine
and postpone the mousiness discussion until after we've tried this wine. So I'm opening a bottle of wine now that I think is really one of those wines that often gets mentioned when we talk about is a fault a fault. And this bottle of wine is from Lebanon. It's from the Bekaa Valley. It's Chateau Muzar. And it's a 2004 vintage.
And it's the red. Just
yes, the Muzar red.
And Emily will tell you whether it's a typical vintage in Muzar.
So in the past, what's the issue with Muzar? In the past, I come here as a position of somebody who loves Muzar and has bought Muzar in the past quite a lot. But I remember when I first tried it, you go, wow, that's different. And I've seen analyses of Muzar that have shown very high levels of volatile acidity, but also Brettanomyces as well. Almost like this is a training tool to tell people what wines with VA and Brettanomyces can be like.
Jamie, do you want to tell our...
Jamie's just broken okay. The cork.
Okay. Yes, even the cork is faulty in this case. do you want to tell our sole listener what VA is?
So volatile acidity. VA is volatile acidity. So it's produced by bacterial action, Acetobacter, It can actually start in the vineyard. You can have grapes coming in where there's some bacterial activity transforming the components in the wine into acetic acid, which is vinegar, and ethyl acetate, which is like smells a bit like nail polish remover.
Mm-hmm.
And together, this level can creep up in a wine. All wines will have some level of VA, but then it's often produced during fermentation by bacterial action. Especially if you allow more oxygen in, because that allows the bacteria to grow. So if you don't top up your barrels enough, the bacteria can start growing again. And then, you end up with a level that you can get to a level that's above
a regulated the amount.
There's a legal limit, but there's a threshold where you can have VA that you can still spot as that slightly vinegary lift on the nose before it gets to be a legal problem. So good winemaking, usually red winemaking we're talking about here normally, but also sweet wines can often have a very high level of VA. Good winemaking will aim to keep the VA level down, but a little bit can be quite complexing. Too much, when is too much? That's the discussion.
Do you find, like, I find that in certain respects, in red wines, VA is quite complexing and interesting, but in white wines, it's sort of a bit beyond the pale. I don't know whether it's just adding to the perception of acidity or
what. Well, often VA comes along with oxidation. So you get oxidative characters side by side with VA. So you can't really separate them out sometimes. So a wine that's a little bit oxidative maybe have that bruised apple sort of acetaldehyde character, as well as acetic acid and ethyl acetate. And so that's sort of slightly oxidized oxidative character. You're often getting VA in the mix there as well. So I'm about to pour this, the Musard 2004. Emily, would you like to, as a sommelier, would you like to just test that? I'm looking forward to trying this. The colour's good. This is a 20-year-old wine now. Good colour.
It's still got a way ahead of it, eh?
It's quite youthful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love the nose. Yeah, I don't know why I always associate cedars of Lebanon with this wine. It's like I smell like cedar wood and sandalwood and all sorts of like slightly exotic notes.
Mm. Yeah. I find it quite umami as well on the nose, but there's still a lot of fruit there, and the palate's got quite a good level of concentration.
Yes.
Acidity's nicely fruity. Integrated. The tannins are softening, so you can see that it's developing. But it still has a bit of time ahead of it.
Spicy, it's a tiny bit earthy. It's not developed as much as you think. I don't think there's any VA there that's troubling.
No.
There's a little
so that
lift.
Earthy, almost touch of truffle, almost.
So this is a blend of Sanso, Cabernet Sauvignon and...
Carignan,
yeah. And the aging is interesting. So it was it a year in concrete, then some time in barrel, then it goes back to vat?
Yeah, it's back to stainless and then into bottle, yes.
Yeah, so I think the varietals are vinified separately, then they're blended, then they go into vat before bottling. And you said usually kept back for, like, how many years at the winery, roughly?
Several years. I mean, I think we're on, I can't remember, sort of 2018 now is the current vintage.
It's nice, actually. The more that the more air the wine's getting, the more the fruit's coming out as well. Some of those tertiary flavours are taking a little bit more of a backseat. This also has that balsamic-y kind of note, though, no?
It's warm, it's a little bit spicy, it's a tiny little bit earthy, but it's not in any level, I would say. I wouldn't call this as being Brettanomyces. Maybe there's some there, but I don't think of it as being Brett. I don't think of VA. I think of a... It's got some oxidative characters,
but that's
a little
the
bit.
Aging and...
But that's the ageing... character. And if you said to me this was from Rioja, for instance, I wouldn't disagree. It's got a little bit of
a sort of leathery, almost like Provençal sort of like element to it, like a little bit of curbs and garrigue and a sort of like a warm leathery background, which is a secondary aromatic.
And I get a little bit of like cherry liquor almost.
So this is interesting. So I think maybe we should be cautious about
calling it a faulty wine.
Calling Musard.
Doesn't taste very faulty right now. Faulty.
But
there have been vintages.
There are some, and there are some people who dismiss Musard without even tasting it, I guess.
I'm really impressed with this. I like it a lot. It's got some warmth. It's a 14% alcohol. It's not excessively high.
It's not crazy, no.
But it's got some sweetness and warmth. You know,
it does, but without
climate wine.
But without too much density. There's still like a lighter touch. If you think about wines with these varietals,
they're often
other
soupy
places.
And dark,
red wine soup, exactly, like this jammy soup that you have to wade through, whereas this is, there's a digestible characteristic to this.
Really impressed with this.
And so, I think the blend of the grapes probably helps as well. I mean,
the Carignan.
When you've got Cabernet as the backbone, it's a good backbone to have in terms of giving the wine lift and acidity, but you've got Sanso, which is
very
pretty floral grape. And
Sanso and Carignan, they're both varieties that just seem to handle hot climates and hot vintages very well. You know, they don't shrivel, they keep their freshness. And Cabernet Sauvignon is such an adaptable variety. It can work in cooler climates.
Yeah.
It can work in warmer climates. And it seems to manage them both quite well. And so this is an impressive wine. So maybe it's the wrong wine to choose for this discussion, but it's quite nice to drink.
But maybe it's also great because it's like a myth. We're myth busting right now, for the 2004 vintage.
Yeah.
Everybody who's on the fence going on.
Before we open this, we were going to talk about Mouse. Now, Mouse is the fault of our times. I'd never heard of it. until I started experiencing it. And I went and studied what it's about. And I remember speaking to some French researchers who've been researching it, because this basically a fault that's on the rise. And the one sure way of avoiding mousiness is to add some sulfites at juice or at a grape reception. Just a little bit of sulfur dioxide seems to deter mousiness. But some people have made wines, well, a lot of people now make wines with no added sulfites, especially at the beginning. I mean, I'd say that was the norm now, unless you've got good grapes. It's like a lot of people don't add sulfites. Even more conventional producers don't tend to. Some people get lucky, some people don't. Some people end up with mousiness. And it's a horrible fault, I think, because if you can taste it, it's always faulty. But people vary dramatically.
Oh, and it builds up with the momentum as well.
People vary dramatically in their ability to spot it. And I reckon, Doug, as a wine importer, it must be a pain, because the natural wine community, the story around mouse is that it comes and goes. And so if someone's sent you 3 pallets of wine and you open a bottle and it's mousy, you can't send it back to them because they say, oh, just wait 6 months and then it'll be gone.
Yeah,
it's not that it's gone, though, is it? Like, I had a conversation with Eric about that. It's not that it's gone. It's just a bit the flavour of it becomes dormant, basically, but it's still there.
You know, I'm not entirely sure of the science, but I will agree. For me, it's the most annoying of faults. But I don't know whether... I mean, as Jamie said, you can put sulfur in it, that's sort of with the reception. I don't know whether that is the insurance. You certainly... if you put it in before bottling, it locks the mouse in. Yeah. And also when you taste the wine before bottling, it may not show any mousiness, and the mousiness may develop in the bottle. If it develops in the vat or the tank, you can add sulfur then, and maybe it will work. You have to add a lot of sulfur, from what I understand from winemakers. But it infuriates me. I hate the taste of it. It's just obnoxious. And I hate the fact that it is very much on the rise. And it is a commercial embarrassment as well, because, you know, when you have to break the news to the producer, and, you know, they're small producers, they don't have a lot of money. What are they going to do? Sometimes they'll argue the toss with you and say no one else has complained, and you have to, you know, be the enforcer. Obviously, as an importer, we'll accept back any wines that are mousy. We try to taste as much as possible, but you can only taste on reception, and the wine may have been fine when it left, and then whatever. So I wonder, Jamie, if you can maybe answer, are there precursors to mousiness in the vineyard, in the farming, that could be avoided? You know, are there sort of like, yeah, other preconditions which, if the farming was better or the grape selection was better, that, and you could still make no sulfur wine in the assurance that it would not turn mousy?
That's a really good question. I'd say the only thing I can aware of is that usually, because it's bacteria that cause it, so pH is the factor. So if you're working with a very low pH, then
less likely.
It's much less likely. So whites at low pH, bingo. Reds, obviously, the pH is often a bit higher. In some vintages, I think that may be the thing that's allowing the bacteria to do their thing. I wonder whether also the fermentation conditions can be quite interesting. So if you've got like a good fermentation where the population of yeasts is filling that sort of nutrient space, then maybe the bacteria have a harder job doing the...
Yeah, I was going to add that actually as a point, because I've seen that with some of the growers that I work with directly, that the perfect storm, let's say, for mousiness to arrive is when fermentation has slowed down and not completed, and malolactic has started before the primary fermentation is finished. And that is like, boom, we're ready for mousiness. So when that happens, that's when the winemaker, before the wine gets bottled, it's still in tank, it needs to be sulfured in tank, not to an excess, I believe, but then it needs to settle before it's bottled, and that's usually how it's handled. But it seems to be that, I've seen that a few times, it's something to do with the bacteria during the fermentation process when it's not completed.
And maybe it goes back to maybe the pH is rising. One of our Austrian producers was theorising that...
Because of climate chaos.
Climate change, yeah, exactly. They were seeing pHs rise, like, on their wines, and they were getting mousy wines, which they never had before. I mean, it wasn't a major occurrence for them, but it never happened. And now it was beginning to happen. And now they were having to take, well, precautions, whether it was during the fermentation or after the fermentation or before the fermentation. They were having to be very aware of this being a thing. Whereas I think once upon a time, people were just making natural wines and saying, well, I don't need to add anything. It will happen. You know, que sera, sera. You know, fermentation is wild. It's da-da-da-da. But now I think, you know, it's a fact of life. We need to deal with it. And, you know, like any sickness, it has to be treated one way or the other, whether holistically at the beginning, you know, in the farming and the selection of grapes needs to be paramount, or, you know, while the patient is on the table or in the tank.
I think as well, one of the factors in that, just going back to some of the stuff we've also discussed in previous episodes. So with the rise of natural wines and more lower sulfur wines on the, or no sulfur wines on the market, I think obviously we're seeing a rise in mousiness just because there's more of these wines being made in this way available to a wider range of us. That's the first thing. And then this ambiguity that we have, or lack of information or understanding of where it's coming from, what's causing it from, is if we look at a lot of wine science is funded by a lot of the big industrial wineries. And obviously, if they're sulfuring the wines, mousiness isn't really coming up as a topic. So I also wonder if our lack of knowledge comes from that, like, because it's not so relevant for the people that are actually funding the science behind this stuff. And I don't know if maybe you have more insight into whether there are growers looking into this and
what I know
what
that
the progression is with that.
The Inter-Rhône guys and the Inter-Beaujolais professional bodies were both looking at this, because Rhône and Beaujolais, they've seen it happen for their growers, and they're looking after their growers, and they're trying to do something about it. And I think that's really positive. So mousiness is such a, the thing is, it's such a mystery. It's so indefinable and it's so changeable. And the other thing is, when you have a bottle of wine, sometimes I've got a like slight premonition when I start tasting it. It's not mousy, but I think this may go mousy.
It has that almost like sweetness to
and
it,
it's
though,
like,
doesn't
and
it?
And you just, no, not mousy, but I know I've got like 45 minutes to get to the end of that bottle. I remember having at the Four Horsemen in New York, the only time I've been there, we ordered a Le Feu from Domaine Belliard.
Yeah. Oh, was
amazing.
It was an
08. Amazing.
08.
It might have been, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, there's a really
towards
mousy
the
vintage.
End, towards yeah. the end, it's like, it's turning. But fortunately, we drank it quite quickly.
But that I don't understand, because I thought...
It's oxygen. It's suddenly, when you open the bottle, the oxygen suddenly... is doing yeah. something to those compounds, not the bacteria, it's
yes.
doing something to those compounds.
Mousiness grows, the more it's open, it gets worse.
So suddenly you're perceiving them, whereas before you weren't.
The wine's also warming up.
But
the wine's also warming up.
But if it was chilled, if it was kept at a constant chilled temperature, would those compounds aromatise more slowly and you may not detect them? Or is
did you have it on ice? Because you probably didn't have it on ice.
This is a few years back.
I reckon it would have been. It would have also warmed up, and that
yeah.
would be a factor.
But I know, like, and I had a red from Ganeva a while back, where we drank 2/3 of it in one evening, and then the next day, and I thought, oh, we should have drunk it all. The next day was super mousy. The first
yeah.
day wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it was fine.
Yes.
So this we're dealing with these little fresh. And the other thing that obviously, dear listeners, if you not really encountered a mousy wine, you can't smell it. So you can sniff a wine, but you can't smell the mouse. It has to be in your mouth, and the pH of your mouth changes it to the point that suddenly you're perceiving through retronasal olfaction these aroma compounds, the tetrahydropyridines. So one way to test it is to take a wine, put it on your skin, which will change the pH if you don't want to like actually drink the wine. Just smell it like that. And the other thing is you can do is just change the pH of the wine chemically as well by putting, I think, bicarbonate or something in it. And
that's
then
a bit of an effort for most of us.
No,
though.
But that's if you're doing if you're analysing 70
okay,
wines,
yeah, yeah.
you don't really want to drink
yeah,
them all.
Yeah,
I doubt it behind my ears.
Yeah,
but so. It's amazing how like if you put it on your wrist, your wrist smells like
you said popcorn,
what I call,
no?
Yeah, dropped cinema popcorn. Like, not even good popcorn, stale popcorn that's been in this on the cinema floor for like a couple of days.
It's and how do you know what that tastes
did
like?
Did you work in a cinema? Is that one of your many
to,
lives?
I'm desperate when I go to the movies. You smell it when you go to a cinema.
The floor,
it's like it's a reeks of
the,
like,
old, the older messes. The better.
Ooh, that's a nice old bit of popcorn there. Ooh, it's at least 3 days old. Ooh, love
how
that.
Do you think I got into wine? I started comparative cinema popcorn tasting.
So aside from mouse is difficult and complicated. The one area we haven't really explored
oxidation.
Too much, oxidative. Oxidant, yeah. Oxidation, oxidative. Yeah. I remember in New Zealand, I went with some New Zealand winemakers to a bar and I saw they had an old Vigna Tondonia, a Blanco, it's a Spain.
Also the Moussard White, right? Is also...
Yeah. Anyway, that's fun. Don't say, you know, I've been in New Zealand for a while, hadn't seen all that many really super interesting wines. So I bought a bottle. And poured it, and then the New Zealand winemakers were calling the wait staff over to send it back, and said, "No, stop! This is supposed to taste like this." And I think that's a kind of oxidative character for many winemakers as a flaw, but in the context of some wines, can be really interesting. And we're not just talking about oxidation; just oxidative. Mm. And this gets really interesting because you know, you've got Fino sherry, biologically aged sherry, Fino and Manzanilla. They have acetaldehyde as part of their flavour signature. They're fresh, they oxidise quickly, but they've got oxidative notes as part of their flavour signature, or the Jura wines with them that aren't topped up, you know, that they have that similar biological, you know, floor layer influence. And floor, I think, is really interesting in wines. But one of the compounds that floor produces is acetaldehyde, which is an oxidation marker, even though these wines aren't oxidised, because they will oxidise quite fast when you open them. So that's really interesting. You're looking at a suite of aroma compounds, some of which you associate with oxidation, even in wines that aren't oxidative or oxidized. And then you have wines that are deliberately a little bit oxidative that can be really interesting.
But again, there's that spectrum.
And then also we look at...
We're talking about wines that can also be just aged in barrels.
Old wine. So old wine, we love old wine, yeah? Everyone, I love old wine. But then you're judging it slightly differently. So if this characters in the old wine were appearing in a wine that was 1 year old, you might be alarmed. But an old wine's different because it's the context again.
Yeah, it's also, and when you go back to Van Zoon in the Jura, you open it, oxygen gets to it, it doesn't change. I mean, it really doesn't. And you can, it's another one of those wines. You can open 5 weeks, 6 weeks, and can age 30, 40, or 50 years.
But that's interesting because the Fino Sherry.
But the Fino Sherry is different, isn't it?
It's different, yes. Yeah, because that's more fragile, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is more fragile.
But an Amontillado is not.
No, because
an Oloroso is definitely.
That's full oxidative.
Yeah, they're oxidative. Yeah,
yeah, so, but
they're still relative, slightly reductive with the floor, right? Like it's still.
You know, the problem
of
Fino, I think, to a certain extent, is that it's filtered. Charcoal filtered. There's nothing to protect it. You know,
like Enrama wines are different, though.
Yeah. Wines which are on the lees.
Maybe they last longer.
And left on the lees. I think that also helps to continue the reductive anaerobic
environment. Also, when you've got a concentration of flavour, you've got a mineral concentration, maybe that's protective. I've heard that in Hungary for the first time. Someone was saying this terroir makes wines that just don't oxidise.
Yeah.
Very mineral. And I was thinking, this sounds like pseudoscience. But now I'm thinking... Yeah, I'm intrigued by this idea.
But it's it's interesting that also if I think of reds from Suertes, they're obviously not made oxidatively. They're quite reductive, but I think that's also the varietal, it's the winemaking, but...
it's the terroir, I think.
It's the terroir.
Yeast, yeah.
And when you open one of the reds, it's like, you can go back to it 2 weeks later and it's just like still popping. And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
And acidity as well. I mean, Jamie, you talked about Rioja. I mean, like, Rioja, we always think is warm climate, but isn't it? It's like high altitude, and you get extraordinary acidity, which keeps the wines on a plateau for 30 or 40 years, red Rioja, but also white Rioja. You know, Viura has got amazing acidity, and this texture, this minerality, combined, I think, almost with oxygen, gives an oxidative character, which is a preserving character, you know.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that resilience
in a shape, yeah,
that you mentioned at the beginning. And I think, I mean, if I think about the most resilient wine in the world, it's Madeira, right? Like,
oh, Madeira, yes.
You don't even need to leave a cork on it; you can just leave it out open,
yeah.
And that wine is very, very sturdy. in general. Yeah.
And the white Mousar, which, you know, when you mention, is in ages insanely well. It's
it's a bit like I put the white Mousar in the same category as like white Tondonia, like yes. the Lopez de Heredia whites. Like it's the same level of being an icon wine. Also, one of those wines that I feel is delivering excellent value, but also unique.
But I feel what this whole sort of subject is probably just slightly distorted by our sort of binary world. So, you know, we think of wines being in terms of white and red, and it's, you know, that's such a relative term. A New Zealand Sauvignon is a white wine, and Tondonia is a white wine, but what part of the spectrum are they on? They're in totally different parts of the spectrum.
This is a great point, Doug. And actually, what I love, I go to this festival, Simplesmente Vinos, every year in Portugal, which is all like authentic wines without makeup from Portugal. And they have some guest wineries as well. And one of the things we're seeing happening in Portugal is the emergence of palietes, where the wine isn't white or red. It's a blend of red and white grapes co-fermented. And it's a very traditional thing. Often field blends, you know, vineyards would have been planted with red and white grapes in the same vineyard and harvested together, making a light, nutritious, ethereal, pale red wine that's in that in-between land between rosé and red that you can drink a lot of. And that would have been, it's a very traditional style from Portugal. And I think we're seeing more of that sort of thing, where we're seeing the blurring of the lines between white, rosé, red, and where we're seeing this almost continuum. And I think this is one of the things that, aside from, you know, looking at the broader picture, one of the things that the last 15 years, and largely led by the natural wine movement, has done is increased people's acceptance and desire for red wines that aren't deep in colour. It used to be when I first started our wine, I mean, I was guilty of this, you know, see a dark wine. It's like, whoa, it's so dark, it's so rich, and it's beautiful. There's nothing wrong with dark wines. But now I think there's a much more of an appreciation for lighter coloured red wines that can be ethereal but still profound. And I think the other thing is you go to South America.
Yes.
Go to South America and you've got País or Mission, yeah, or the Criollas from Argentina, that these grapes that were despised, that's the winemaking heritage of these countries. And, you know, the invaders brought these grapes, you know, the big bunches of, you know, not full coloured red grapes, they're now being used to make some very interesting wines. And I think that's fabulous.
You know, we forget culture. When we talk about wine, we always talk about it on a sort of scale of, like, you know, as if it could be objectively marked, and, you know, like wines which have more in them, more colour, more oak, more weight, they're more flattering, are better wines because more has gone into them. But you have to remember that wine was originally like a peasant drink. I mean, and these Criollas wines and the sort of wine Pais and a lot of European wines, the Palette wines you're referring to, they're pale and light in body because they were designed to be drunk for refreshment, because they were delicious with food. They weren't meant to be shipped halfway across the world for, I don't know, critics to, you know, mark them and say, yeah, they're lacking oak, or they're lacking colour, or they're lacking this. I think the lack of something in a wine, the less there is, often the more there is, because the more you can appreciate it for being the delicious drink, the less the construct, the almost architectural construct of an oenologist who's putting together all the pieces to make something which is like ticks all the boxes. This is where I love natural wines, is often how easy they are to drink. And the more pretentious winemaking, I think, can obfuscate that. And that's considered to be correct. And the natural side is like, there's something missing there. There's something that, you know, there's something more we should appreciate. We went out to, we three went out to dinner to Braun, and I remember I brought a Carasur wine, And this is a winery in Calingasta in San Juan region of Argentina. We've gone back to the idea of, like, you know, these pale, pretty wines made from criollos, you know, sort of crossings of grapes. And you pour them into the glass and you think, is that a rosé? Is that a red? Doesn't matter. It doesn't. And then these beautiful red fruit flavors, flowers, dry, you know, almost like Nebbiolo-esque type thing. Almost no tannins. Just it just eases across the palate like fluidly, like, you know. And you think that was just lovely. And almost you don't want to consider it anymore. Then you don't want to describe it. It just is. It just is what it is. And one of the people in our, let's say a little group, literally said, is that it? You know, like, it's a bit like you tell a story or a joke. And it's like, it doesn't have to have a punchline. That is what it is.
Mm.
And he was really disappointed because he expected this, you know, like, iconic architectural wine. And we were really happy with the wine. Because,
it's a beautiful wine.
We all said it's beautiful. And beautiful is, it's a nebulous word, but it connects us, you know, what our feeling about the wine is. And I think flaws, I think the wine, if it had like flaws, it would be flaws for an oenologist, but not for us as just humble, appreciative drinkers.
More's not always more in that case, right?
No, less is. Less is more. I mean, I drink, you know, wine every evening. I don't want to be impressed constantly. I mean, there are times that you admire a wine, but you wouldn't want to live in it type thing. It's like a cathedral. I admire the architecture, but I live in a house. I want something which is functional, which is thirst quenching and goes really well with food and sort of makes me want another glass. I don't want to look at a glass and think, well, that's pretty amazing looking, but sorry, I can't get into it. It's too alcoholic. It's too oaky. You know, I tend to criticize wines which I think oenologists and a lot of high scoring wines, I would find them not charming, I guess, is what I want to say.
Well, it's a different approach, isn't it? Because if it's kind of like reverse engineered in that way. Like if you look at like a grower is, I'm in tune with the vineyard, I'm working with the fruit that this year, I'm picking, I'm looking at what I've got, and then I'm making a decision, what do I do with what I've got and what I've grown, and how do I express that in the way that I can express that? Whereas if we, like, flip that, it's like a different model of the oenologist wine, where it's like, there were 8 of us in a room that thought about this concept. Okay, what are all the decisions I make now to make sure that concept comes into fruition? It's different.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts? Because I know we're nearing our time, right? Jamie's given me the, it's almost 1 hour, it's 1 hour.
No, I think my final thought would be is that I like this discussion a lot. Lots of things we haven't touched on, like the nature of beauty that we could touch on. And I think there's, I really appreciate this sort of, the multitude of wine styles that now we encounter that are being taken more seriously. Whereas in some ways it's like going to the cellar now in most wineries. In the past it was just stainless steel and small oak. Now it's like I'm going to you'll see all sorts of alternative élevage. You know, that this is a wine at a certain level has become, you know, even outside of natural wine, has become much more thoughtful. Let's see what we can produce that it really is a faithful and intelligent interpretation of the place. And that's, I think, is really exciting. And I think a lot of it, you know, your response to wine is determined by, are you curious? Are you willing to accept new flavours? And as we go, if we decide we're going to embark on that journey of trying new things, accepting new flavours, then our experience and our familiarity with things that in the past were unfamiliar then increases our enjoyment of them. It's like people's faces. They've done studies where a face you see lots, you grow to like more. So you grow to like things the more you experience them, unless they're really very, very bad things. There's this sense of your appreciation aesthetically grows with repeated experience. And I think it's like that with wine. I remember when I first started eating cheese as an adult, I hated it until I, you know, maybe I was 35 and I was on a trip to Portugal and I'd always avoided cheese. I thought, I don't like cheese. And then I thought, well, let's try some. So I was in Portugal in the Douro region, tried some queijo de serra from the Serra da Estrela. Quite a complicated cheese, not a beginner's cheese, but I thought, I'm going to try this because I neglected this thing that initially my palate says, this is not good. You should not be eating this. I'm like, no, I'm going to. So I try it, and now I love this stuff. I love cheese now a lot, whereas I didn't eat any cheese until I was 35. So this is another topic we can discuss at some other stages, how our relationship to flavour changes.
Evolves,
with experience.
And I think wines also evolve in terms of the way the winemakers perceive the terroir on which they operate. And I think most winemakers, and I think I include conventional and natural in the same embrace here, is they really want to make the wine that reflects the place that they're making, you know, the vineyards they're spending the time in. But how they shape that wine eventually is so many choices that they make. So a recent trip I just come back from, southern France, is everybody is now moving towards concrete, really soft extractions. They call it infusions rather than extractions. Yeah. They just want like 5 days on skins. They just want this sort of sense of the personality of the wine to triumph over the stainless steel or the wooden vessel. This is why they're moving. It's a move away more towards concrete and clay but just less invasive winemaking and more gentle accompaniment. And if there are flaws, if the nature of the vintage is very particular, they will be captured in the wine. It's about not superimposing something, an idea of perfection, on what is essentially an imperfect product.
Yeah, Doug, thank you. What a way. I think that's the perfect finish for this episode. And for those of you that are listening and not already following us on Instagram, follow us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast. And yeah, I'm Emily Harmon. Thank you. Till next time.
See you next week.
See you. Jamie Good signing out.